you'd really cover a lot and meet every day of the week. Okay?
Most of my classes at Berkeley are like that.
I'm sorry?
Most of my classes at Berkeley are like
that. Is that right? Well, maybe there are places where they do that.
3 hours of lecture.
There's an awful lot of duplication in college that I guess it's hard to eliminate. The education people teach educational psychology, and the psychology people teach the psychology of education. And there's even duplication between what physics teaches and what chemistry teaches. They have tried to root out as much of that as they can, but still, and maybe it's all right, because you don't learn things the first time around, and a chemist will sort of approach it from a different angle than a physicist, and it may be helpful. Anyway, there is so much in the world that's interesting and that we ought to know, you just can't cover it. So, I've experimented with this course and maybe we'll do it different if I ever get to teach one again. I think next time I would use a book. I might not spend much time talking about it, but I'd require you to read it, see, and ask you a couple of questions on each chapter, maybe once a week, and then just throw in stuff that might be interesting and create the perspective that I hope maybe you've been able to get. At least maybe get an idea of how one scientist works in some ways. This won't affect your grade any, but how many of you honestly have worked 6 hours a week at something in chemistry? Have any of you done it?
Each week.
Yeah, 6 hours. Well, an average of six, I don't care, you know, just an average since the course started. Yeah, that means 24 hours a day for at least 1 week, I guess. Well, see, maybe I haven't worked. Are you holding up your hand or are you saying you did?
No, I
didn't. Well, that's pretty good. One class member did.
That was
good. Well, that's... That is a problem. If we had a text, I think maybe you'd be more, particularly if I were requiring problems to be worked, that would force your hand, I guess. As honor students, I thought maybe, you know, I told you to read this, that, and the other at the beginning. Maybe you, on your own steam, would do it. But you may not be too much different than other human beings, and you just don't get it done.
Well, one comment about that. Three-hour classes, you don't put in 6 hours a week.
You don't anyway.
No, I put in 6 hours a week in all my classes. Just because this class, I put
it in. How many do you think you put in on a three-hour class outside most of
some of them
are
work. Maybe an hour a week.
Only an hour a week?
Well, for some classes, I really need to.
Well, I guess it depends, because I've heard my own children, four or five or six of them, who've gone to college here, saying that sometimes the 2 and 3 hour ones were the worst because they gave you, they acted like it was a 5 hour course. Brother Williams.
I have a positive comment about that system though, is that I haven't spent the 6 hours, but the stuff that I have read I found much more interesting than if I had gone through a textbook. And I've got a textbook that I've been going through, but I've been skipping the parts that weren't interesting to me. And I think that's been real valuable in my case.
Well, for me it was an experiment. And I hope to learn.
There was a lot of interesting things I read.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Chem 100 is especially hard to take because to teach and to take. We have those 15 chapters and we do a chapter a week and you really struggle to do it. And it's really kind of boring, I must admit. But, and maybe they'll forget more than you have learned. I don't know. Brother?
I had quite a bit of chemistry in high school. So I didn't do all of the 6 hours, but I did, you know, really look over that periodic table, and the stuff that was, when I felt like I really needed to know something, you know, went after the, you know, looked up a bunch of stuff about oil and saturated fats and everything, and I got interested in that project you assigned. It was good. I read 3 books for that.
Good.
It was something I was really interested in, something I planned to, you know, I wanted to learn someday.
Yeah. Well, of course, much of life is a hard grind. You know, and you need to buckle down and learn it, even if it's not interesting. But I don't know. You can't have everything. Let's see. Who haven't heard from?
I agree with what Grant said. Back at towards the beginning of the course, when we were really plowing into stuff that I didn't know anything about, the polyunsaturated stuff, I was doing a lot more research. since you just talked about the way you made diamonds, that's really something that, you know, I wouldn't know where to go for research. It was your experience.
Yeah.
So during this, you could have been reading
popular science, though, you know,
yeah.
Like I suggested, or science, or something like that. Let's see. Cindy?
I think during the time I've been, like, doing mine and reading popular science and reading through basic chem text the whole time. And I agree with what you said, too. During the first, I struggled and I kept, you know, you had focused what we read, and whereas, so when we came to class next time, you can understand what was going on.
No, I lost the focus.
But,
well.
No, I don't think so. That's not what I'm trying to say. Is that I was worried for a while how much I was learning, you know. I didn't think, because I wasn't sure how well it was going, and I have a friend who's getting his master's in organic chemistry. And I could never understand what he said before last time, you know. And I talked to him the other day, and I really felt comfortable discussing things with him, you know. Yeah. Certain aspects, and I really understood what was going on. So I think it's done me some good.
Okay. Jeff, let's hear from you, and then we'll go on with what we want to talk about today.
Well, one thing you might want to do if you just want to give the students a little bit more of a difference is to do outside work, but leave it free so that they can pursue what they want, and say, have turn once a week or twice a week or whatever. Say, if they read an article right up on shit, say half a page of abstract from it, mostly really simple, short, what they felt about it, what they learned, you know, not necessarily some of the article, but how they felt about it, then it would give them, well, gee, I've got to write that abstract, I've got to go and, you know, read
yeah.
it. And it would give them everything out there, but it would not be so much the busy work that you get like 100,
yeah.
I think it would keep the people working.
Well, I had an idea that I would have class reports, and I think that's what they want, but when I got to figuring out how much time it was going to take for 24 class reports, I decided, well, maybe not. Well, let's try something today. I want to talk about energy, or talk around it, one way or the other. We'd like to measure things in this world in as few fundamental quantities as we could possibly imagine. And we would like to relate everything to what we can physically discern. Now, we can physically discern things in space. And we can define space with three coordinates. And the simplest thing for us to use without having had a lot of mathematics and whatnot, some of you have had math, I'm sure, but some haven't, is to say we define space by the coordinates x, y, and z. So we can locate space, you see, by those coordinates. Now there are complications when you want to get real sophisticated. In our everyday life, we work in Provo City all the time because we say, I'm going to see Joe. He lives at 490 East, 600 South. So from a reference system, you see, we can find the place. We do the same thing in science, only we want to do it in three dimensions. We're an airplane now, and we're not tied to the ground. We can move in the plane, you see, of X and Y. We can also move up and down in the Z direction. So with three coordinates, we can specify a location in space. All right, sticking only to coordinates, X, Y, and Z on a coordinate system, where we usually have this as the X-axis, and this axis is mutually perpendicular to this one. We'll call it the Y-axis, and this one, the vertical one, we'll call the Z-axis, and that's rather arbitrary. But with respect to this coordinate system out here in space, we can define other spots. Now, there are other kinds of coordinate systems. Some of you have had math, know there's a coordinate system of polar coordinates in three dimensions, where there's one radius, and that takes two angles. It always takes three numbers to specify the position, no matter what kind of a system you invent. So two angles and a radius can do it, or just three dimensions. I go out here to 500 east, and I come out here to 300 west, and then I go up in the sky 2 miles, that sort of thing, see, and I can define my position. Now, if we deal in a plane, we can start inventing new concepts. We can recognize that something can have an area. And it takes two dimensions to define an area. If this length here is x and this length is y, I say that the area is equal to x times y. Now, my system may not be that kind of a shape. It might be a triangle, it might be a circle, it might be any whole thing. Now, a convenient unit to use in measuring area is a square. And if I want to measure in the English system of inches, I might adopt one square inch, which would be 1 inch on this side in width and 1 inch's length as being my unit of area. And even though this figure is irregular here, I can say that the area of that figure is equal to maybe 3.261 square inches, or whatever. And by calculus, it's possible, of course, to find out that area. If you have some kind, if you know its shape, you can find out its area. And we won't delve with that, but you can relate that area to the area of a bunch of squares, and then maybe a fraction of a square, this 0.261 part of a square, you see. And that's the way we do areas. Now, in three-dimensional space, we can do volumes. And there, we would have the added dimension of the height, the z. So, the volume, then, is equal to x times y times z. And no matter how potato-shaped or irregular a shape is, if you know the shape, you can, by means of calculus, find out what the volume of the thing is. And again, it takes three dimensions to specify the volume. If this room were a perfect cube, say 20 feet there, 20 feet there, 20 feet high, the volume would be 20 times 20 times 20, which would be 8,000 cubic feet. But the room is irregular, and an engineer or somebody could figure out the true volume if he knew the shape of things through certain cross sections. He could figure out the volume. Well, in the concept of space, then, we have come to the idea of a position, and we can locate positions with respect to some reference system. We have come to the idea that we can have such a thing as an area, and we've come to the idea that we can have such a thing as a volume. Now, there are more sophisticated things about space that one gets into if he gets into Einstein's theory and a lot of other things. But for us everyday chemists, there are some important things about space. Position, area, volume. I should have added another one. We measure in a linear direction length. We say that the thing is so long, 9.3 inches long. On the metric system, we convert that to the metric system, or we can measure it in miles or kilometers or one and a rods, perches, maybe perches, not a length. Chains, you can still go down to Utah County and get the description of a piece of property and say so many chains long or so many rods long. Units established long ago for measuring that are still used. So we have many units of length. We have many things in which we can describe the area and the volume. The world is tending to go towards a metric system, but I think it'll really be a long time before the entire world is really on the metric system. Now, what in addition to space is a fundamental concept that we can deal with? Time. Time is a strange one.
what I just said, I can never bring back, you know. It's gone. It's the hardest to wrap our minds around, so to speak. It's a variable with those of us who are living beings. If I start my car in the morning, which is an awfully bulky automobile, till it warms up, and I sit there and I look at my watch. Now, I got to let it warm up for a full minute, or it'll just stall, and I'll waste another minute trying to get it started. And as I watch that second hand go around, that seems like an hour, doesn't it? And you had a few young people are out with your boyfriend or girlfriend up Rock Canyon some night. Man, it's you go at 9 o'clock and it's 1 a.m. and your mother and dad are wondering where the heck you are, and you thought it was just a minute. My teenage daughter is on the telephone, and I sit over in my office trying to call my wife, and I start calling her at 3 o'clock, and I try again at 15 after, still busy. And 2 hours can go by, and when I get home at night, I'll say, Nancy, you know how long you're talking on that phone, and I had important business with Mom. And, well, I was only on the phone for about 5 minutes, Dad. So, time is a kind of a relative thing with us. When we're young, we can't wait. Christmas never seems to come. As you get older, it seems to be universal that time just goes so fast. You just can't imagine how fast last year went when you get as old as I am, 55, and it sits even faster when you're 70. So it's a peculiar thing, but we assume that for most measurements we want to make, that time flows at a constant rate, and that we can measure it and we can use it in scientific things. Now, science began to advance and technology began to advance when man became conscious. Of such variables as space and time, and tried to put them down in quantitative form and establish principles on which you could measure things. And as soon as you could measure things, then you could make progress far beyond what you could do before you couldn't measure things. And part of the game of science is constantly trying to improve the measurement of things. Let's talk a little bit about the measurement of time. We used to measure time by looking at the stars. And the ancients observed that there were certain stars that just seemed immovable. They were fixed. Polar star being such a star. It's just there, and with the ordinary devices of looking through a hole here that corresponded with a hole here, like they apparently did on this continent and did over in Stonehenge in England and other places, and then telescopes were developed and whatnot, there seemed to be immovable things that were fixed, and we could take reference of the rotation of our Earth with respect to things like that. And we established the day, and we established the year, and we divided the day into hours, and the hours into minutes, and the minutes into seconds. But astronomical observations were the standard of time, considered to be very accurate. Well, now, in recent years, the standard of time, let me speak about length. The standard of length came about in a practical way. How far it is between a man's outstretched hands, the tip of his fingers, things like that. The foot apparently came from the length of a man's foot. Might have been a king's foot or somebody. It became a foot. And things grew up in this way, just certain arbitrary distances. Now, as the years passed and men tried more and more to measure things accurately, they finally decided that they would establish a standard length. And they made it the meter. They made the meter out of a platinum alloy so it would not corrode or rust. And then they kept this meter, they keep this meter still at constant temperature in France in a vault. And they have two lines. This meter stick, solid platinum, but pretty valuable. A meter, you see, is in about the same as you are. On that, they have an engraved line at one end and an engraved line at the other end.
The distance between those two lines is a standard meter. And if you're making some scientific instrument or just making a yardstick or a ruler of any kind, even though it be in the English system or some other system, you're supposed to go back and ultimately, you see, measure that distance very accurately and then use that as your standard. Okay?
Now, one thing I've always wondered is, if you make a mark on that, the mark has width, and so how do you decide where on the mark to measure?
Problem, isn't it? Yeah. Well, they tried to make a very fine V groove, and you look at the bottom of the groove, but even the bottom of the groove is going to have width. Well, I look at this with various measuring devices, and I won't go into the details of those measuring devices, but they'll run a microscope along and we'll look at the bottom of the groove with a microscope and try and center in the bottom of the groove. And they'll take dozens of measurements and then take an average, a statistical, scientifically calculated average of all the measurements. Jeff?
They don't use that anymore, do they?
Well, yeah. You're ahead of me in my life, yeah. Is that what you're going to tell me? Okay. Well, duplicates of this have been made, and our own U.S. Bureau standard has its own standard meter, which every year or so in past history would be taken to Paris and compared, you know, make sure that things were still okay. Well, now you can worry about other things. See, the meter, what if that meter stick warps just a little bit? Or what if it shrinks? What if the molecular structure of the thing is such that the meter stick shrinks? Well, now, I don't believe they were too smart in the way they did this meter thing, but what you usually do in a system of, see, this is an arbitrary standard. The smart thing to do is to make a meter stick of lots of things. Make one of stainless steel, make one of platinum, make one of gold, and locate them in different spots and then intercompare those from time to time, you see. And if they all stay the same, within reason, then you say, well, I guess this one isn't shrinking with time or this one isn't expanding with time and things like that. I worked in an analytical lab. My first work as a chemist was at Sperry Mills in Ogden, I guess back around 1939. And there were other labs of Sperry Mills in the east and the west. And every once in a while, to make sure we were on our toes, they'd send us an unknown sample. And there'd be an analysis of this in the various labs. And then they'd take an average of the three and decide that was the right answer. The average of the three labs, and then use that information to determine the protein content of the flour and whatever else it was we were determining. All right, now as time has gone on, we have learned that there are more accurate standards. They've been invented, really. You know that there's a certain, you know all those tubes we had here that were emitting light. Remember that? The wavelength of those is due, and wavelength, you know, we talked about waves, is due to an electron being promoted to a higher state in the atom and then dropping back to a lower state. And it's been discovered that that can be the measure of length. Very accurate, very unfailing. Doesn't depend too much on temperature or pressure or anything else, only depends on the atom. And apparently, and you're dealing with billions and billions of atoms, even though you have a darn near perfect vacuum, still billions and billions of atoms involved. And statistically, you can depend on an average there that measures as you measure it very accurately. So the wavelength of light, and I'm not sure what the standard is today, it has changed. They have changed from this kind of element to that kind of element. Anybody happen to know? I haven't read in that recently.
Krypton 86.
Krypton 86, you think? Anyway, the wavelength of light itself, which can be set up in any lab easily. If we want a standard right here in Provo, we can have it. You can have it in Moscow. Anywhere you want, and we don't have to worry about a standard meter. All right, now, in the case of time, it was astronomical observations. But now, it's the cesium clock, unless they change it the past few years. Again, based on phenomena at a scale so small your eye cannot see it. In fact, microscopes can't see it. And what you use
is various atomic phenomena involving electrons or the nucleus or something associated with the atom. See, atoms are in constant motion. The electrons are. Certain phenomena in the nucleus are in constant motion. And you can use these as being more accurate than the motion of the planets. Jeff?
Okay, one question. If you're using a cesium clock to measure standard of time, then that standard of time depends upon the time frame in which the cesium is. Because I remember they did an experiment where they did two 747s and they stuck cesium clocks in both and they flew in opposite directions around the world. The one would be going significantly faster than the other one, you know, as much as they could.
Gets into an area that I don't want to get into. Einstein's theory makes lots of complications in space and time. And what Einstein tries to do is connect space and time. It's not being separate entities, but there's an interrelationship of space and time. This gets very complicated. Theory of relativity. Well, anyway, it's very interesting that we used to make our astronomical observations taking place over billions of miles, huge distances, you see, our standard reference frame of time. And now we've gone the exact opposite, down to atoms, so small you can't possibly see them. And that has become our standard time, motions that take place in atoms. Okay?
I have two questions. First of all, when they first figured the standard meter, wasn't it the distance between the equator and the North Pole?
They related it once the dimensions on the Earth.
And then second, how do they measure, if you get a wavelength, but how do you measure the wavelength and you can't see it?
Well, you measure it with interferometers. You know that piece of plastic stuff that we were rotating around trying to see the lines on the spectrum? Remember, I said there were 15,000 lines per inch on there? Those were poor gizmos. Wish I had a good grading to show you, but There are phenomena known as interference phenomena. Interference of one wave with another, which with diffraction type grating things. You can measure down to so tiny it's unbelievable, a distance. You can measure within 1/4 of the wavelength of the line. You get electronics involved and the physical things known as gratings, which are ruled with great precision. There may be more modern schemes that I don't know about. I haven't kept up with this kind of thing. So I don't know. But it is interesting that our standard of length now is at the atomic level and our standard of time is down at the atomic level. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Well, let's let him rest for a while. All right, now, what other kind of things are you aware of that we might stick in these fundamental things that we're concerned with? We have space and time. Now what else is there? Okay?
Matter.
And one property of matter is its mass that we're aware of. So we have mass. Now, the matter itself is very complicated, and of course, chemistry is one of the branches that discusses the properties of matter. And chemistry is mighty complex, awfully complex. Now, if we talk about just the simple things of matter, we can talk about what I have mentioned as mass, as a simple thing. We can weigh things and compare them by weight.
And I don't know where weight originated in past history, but they used to use seeds on a scale. Balances were invented a long time ago, a balance just being a teeter-totter. You put a weight on one side and then change the weight on the other side of the balances, then you say the same. The weights are the same if the length. The length has to be the same. Here's the pivotal point of the teeter-totter. And the length from here to here must be the same as from here to here, where the mass is located. And if the masses are the same, then the thing will be at an exact balance. Now it is possible, I think I have my fulcrum in the center, it is possible to make a scale in which you shift this weight along. If this happens to be a larger weight, if you shift it over here to a new position so that this lever arm is smaller than that lever arm, then you can still achieve a balance. And that's the principle of a scale. And you've weighed yourself on a doctor's scale and shifted the weight along to balance your weight. That can be calibrated to measure the mass. Well, now, what science has tried to do is to take space, time, and mass and use those things only to relate to certain fundamental problems. Now, let's talk about some of those problems. We'll start mixing these things up. You can define some new kind of quantities, and you define them because they're useful. We use such a quantity as density. Density involves mass and volume, or length, you see. We say the density in the metric system is so many grams per cubic centimeter. Use the 3 to indicate that it's a cube. Well, if we write the units on that, the units we have, m for mass and l for length, it's l times l times l to get a volume, or l cubed. So we mix up the units and we define a new quantity that is useful, the density of a substance. Water has a density of 1 gram per cubic centimeter. Gold has a density of 19 grams per cubic centimeter. Now, the person who first had a handle on the idea of density was this man who was assigned by the king to find out to tell when something was not gold. What was his name?
Archimedes.
Yeah, Archimedes. He got the idea that he could use... When he felt he was in the bath, apparently, and suddenly realized the significance of the fact that his arms felt lighter. They were buoyed up by the water. And he got the idea of a way to measure the density of irregular objects that is used to this day, simply by weighing the thing in air and then weighing it in water. And from that, you can calculate the density. Now, what was happening in these ancient times is that guys had learned they could alloy tin or zinc or both of them with copper and make a product that we would call brass that looks like gold. And maybe melt a little gold with it, you see, and then pass off a phony crown of gold that was mostly tin and copper, much cheaper than gold. Well, they do not have the density of gold. That is, the copper and the tin do not. And so a difference in density could show you that you did not have pure gold. Well, density is used in many, many other things other than that. But it's an important quantity. In science, we use the reciprocal of things. The reciprocal of density, I'll use the symbol D, 1 over D, is called a specific volume. And specific volume is simply the number of centimeters cubed that you have in 1 gram. It's the reverse. So, if I say the density of gold is 19 grams per cubic centimeter, the reciprocal tells me that the specific volume of gold is 0.053 cubic centimeters per gram. Our gold up here would be 19 grams per cubic centimeter. Now, sometimes one kind of a description is traditionally used. Density is much more common than specific volume. But there are places in science where you do not speak of density. You always speak of the specific volume, because in a particular context, it's more useful. Well, these reciprocal kind of relationships are all through science. And if this lecture could last for another hour, we'd finally get through it, and I'd give you some other examples. Was there a hand? Okay, this uses a combination of mass and space to define new things known as density and its reciprocal, the specific volume. Let's relate some other quantities. Let's relate time and length. We're familiar in this day of automobiles that we talk about miles per hour, and we call that the speed. The scientific term for speed is the velocity. We use the word velocity. Well, miles is a distance and hour is a time. Now, we could express that in other units than miles. We could express it in centimeters or kilometers or knots, which is a nautical baby term. Velocity, then, in the metric system, we would usually measure as centimeters per second. Those are the dimensions. We say these are the dimensions on the thing that we call the velocity. Or sometimes in the English system, we may say so many feet per second. There's another phenomenon with which we are familiar. And that's the rate at which we change the velocity, the acceleration. You feel that all the time. If you're going along smoothly and then you want to pass a car, the guy steps down on the accelerator rapidly and zoom, you sink back into your seat. That feeling is the feeling of acceleration. You get the same thing in an elevator. Here you are standing still and the elevator suddenly starts to go up and you feel your increased weight, and so you have increased weight. Those feelings are the feelings that we get, and that's called acceleration. So an acceleration is how fast the velocity changes per second. So the dimensions on acceleration, how fast the velocity changes per second, means it will have the dimensions of centimeters per second per second. Are centimeters divided by time squared. So we say the dimensions of acceleration are centimeters per second squared. And we experience all of these kinds of things in our everyday life. Velocity and acceleration. This is a combination of these basic units of length and of time. It's a space-time phenomenon that we're familiar with. Now in science you go still further. We define still other phenomena. We define a thing we call the force. And a force is defined, and I'll use three lines, which is often done in textbooks, to define. This means it's a defined thing. Force is equal to a mass times an acceleration. Now you see we have three things in this picture. We not only have space and time, now we have matter involved. It's mass. The mass or the matter.
Now we experience forces, and we realize that the greater the weight with a given acceleration, the greater the force. Let's see if I can give you an everyday kind of an example. If we let, we know from the Leaning Tower of Pisa experiment, that if you let something fall, they all hit the ground at the same time. Now you see, the rock and the feather were stationary initially. No velocity, no acceleration. But as you let it drop, it goes faster and faster. And if there were no air friction and you dropped up there from quite a ways, things would go faster and faster and faster, like crashed into the earth. But the mass does not matter. The heavy thing falls at exactly the same increase in acceleration and hits the ground at the same time as the feather, if there's no air friction. And if you've taken a physics course, you've probably seen this experiment where they put the feather in a tube. The thing that slows the feather down is the friction of the air. And you put the steel ball and the feather, so there's no air friction, and you drop them and they both hit the ground at the same time. Well, you have a uniform acceleration in that case. But which thing would do the most damage when it hit the ground? The heavy thing or the light thing? The heavy thing would do the most damage. This is the concept of force. You see, the acceleration due to gravity. And when it's gravity that's accelerating things, we use the symbol G in place of the symbol A. There's a constant acceleration due to gravity. But if I make a bigger mass, I'll say that my force is greater. Now, I think we can understand that concept from our everyday experiences. Jeff?
What about when you just have a body moving at constant speed, which is either accelerated or decelerated? Can you define force? There's no force being acted upon.
There's no force.
It's a static body, right?
Static body. If something, these are Newton's laws of motion we're kind of getting into here. If something is moving along at a constant speed and there's no attraction due to gravity or anything else, it will just continue in that same direction forever. That's the theory. And we observe that in practice, as near as we can do the experiments. Something moving at a constant velocity, unacted on by other forces, you don't speak of any force being associated with that body. Of course, if it suddenly is stopped by a wall or something, then it's deaccelerated, you see. There is a change in its velocity. Acceleration means that the velocity, the speed with which it's going, is changed. And if it hits something, there's a deacceleration, and then you can apply this formula. Okay?
Now, how do you tie that in when we say we have counteracting forces, like I push on the table, then I'm pushing back on my chair, it's pushing back on the floor, and then the floor is also being all tied to the table by gravity, so it's pushing back. We think of that as being force, but neither one is really accelerating. Would you really classify that as force?
That is, here I say I'm pushing on that table, but I'm not providing any force because I'm not doing anything to that table. Well, you really are, but you're doing it on a very small scale. I'm compressing the leg of that table. Now maybe it's only a millionth of an inch.
Once it's compressed, all it's going to be compressed, and you're sitting on the table. You're still putting force on it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I've come to a static equilibrium condition.
Its net acceleration is zero because you're putting force on it from the top, and the floor is putting force from the bottom.
Yeah.
That's really not an acceleration, is it?
Well, you can say that in the case of gravity, it is trying to accelerate all of us, but we're stopped by what's in between, you know. These things get philosophical and hard to get your mind around them. Well, let me go on to some more. We're getting out of time. I haven't done to go where I was going. Now we can define another thing that we call work. that's equal to a force times a distance. So we have a mass, acceleration, replaced by a force. This is called a force. I didn't put the units on here. We have mass and acceleration in centimeters over seconds squared, and that G there just was gravity. Okay. These then are the units on a force. Mass, centimeters, seconds squared. Now in the case of work, my dimensions now become a force, which is this thing, dimensions of mass, centimeters per second squared, times the distance is another centimeter, which times that makes this a centimeter squared. And work has the same dimensions as energy. So energy should also have these same dimensions. Well, we'll continue this same kind of business on Wednesday and Friday. Go to a physics book and read about energy, if you can. Or an encyclopedia. Look for, if you didn't follow this too closely, look for force and acceleration and velocity and things like that. Any elementary physics book are encyclopedias. You can look up the word force or acceleration and get more information on this.
I don't know.